Hello and welcome to Science World. Maybe you haven't noticed, but our sun has been really active lately, throwing off a number of solar flares and coronal mass ejections in the past month alone. Joe Kunches from the Space Weather Prediction Center will fill us in on why the sun has been in such an ornery mood lately. Roseanne Skirbel will tell us why some believe that the death toll from tornadoes, such as the one that recently devastated parts of Oklahoma, can be dramatically reduced when people take shelter in underground storm bunkers and hardened safe rooms. And this week, we'll take you to where no man has gone before with a Star Trek brain teaser for you on the Science World Quick Quiz. This and much more coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The scattered ruins of tornado-ravaged Moore, Oklahoma, serve as a grim reminder that current building codes can't do much to prevent loss of life and property destruction, especially when a powerful twister cuts through town. But the death toll can be dramatically reduced when people take shelter in underground storm bunkers and hardened safe rooms. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
Juan Dills is picking through the muddy rubble of his home. He escaped the storm with his life. He's seen all this before, the downed trees, the collapsed houses, the upside-down cars.
We're from Oklahoma. We'll come through. It's normal for weather to be like this. You know, we're all going to stick together and everything will work out. Everything is going to work out.
The tornado that carved a path of destruction through Moore took 24 lives. Its winds were clocked at 400 kilometers per hour. With only 15 minutes warning, residents fled town or took refuge in the sturdiest corner of their homes or other buildings. The luckiest were able to climb into underground shelters or move to steel and concrete modules in their buildings called safe rooms. In Moore and other nearby towns, those rooms saved lives. But at two schools destroyed by Monday's tornado, no such shelter was available. Leslie Chapman Henderson is CEO of a nonprofit group called the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes. She's an advocate for tornado safe rooms.
The safe room is an interior room of the home that's been reinforced, tested, and certified to withstand high wind and debris impacts of the type that we've just seen happen in Moore, Oklahoma. In fact, we've already heard of families and stories of survival for people who were in safe rooms, either above ground or below ground.
A safe room can be retrofitted into a closet, bathroom, laundry room, or garage, or set below ground. Moore resident Sky Strohall watched the tornado's funnel-shaped cloud approaching and ran with a friend to a neighbor's underground shelter with minutes to spare.
And it was just getting a little too scary for me, so I followed him back there and into that backyard, and we tried to open that cellar, and it was locked by a chain, and then they'd let us in. And then shortly after that, it was on top of us.
Better storm forecasts give people like Strohall more time to react, but they need someplace safe to go. Buildings can be built to resist strong winds, but not like those in the F5 tornado that touched down in Moore. Home safety advocate Chapman Henderson says even the building codes that do exist are not widely adopted or enforced.
There are places at the EF 0, 1, and 2 level where a building code can make a difference, but what we really need here is a combination of both the code and the safe room.
Most of the ruined structures in Moore had neither. Only 1 in 10 homes in town have tornado-safe rooms. Moore is located in a central U.S. region called Tornado Alley, where storms are frequent. This is the fourth severe tornado in 14 years, the second with winds of 400 kilometers per hour to cut similar swaths through town. But Chapman Henderson says memories fade. Neither of the two elementary schools demolished this week had safe rooms, which she says could have saved the 7 children who died at one of the schools.
I think we need to focus on our schools, and we need to set a minimum standard of always having a shelter and safe room option for students. What we've learned here tragically is that's the most important investment that we can make.
As the residents prepare to rebuild, Moore's mayor is pushing for an ordinance to make safe rooms mandatory in all new construction. Similar proposals were made following each of the previous tornado strikes, but none were adopted. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
As the dazzling new sci-fi adventure film Star Trek Into Darkness thrills moviegoers, academics, professionals, and Star Trek fans alike are once again discussing the iconic franchise's influence on society, science, and technology. Suzanne Presto has more.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Star Trek's Starship is well known to viewers of the iconic TV series and visitors to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's gift shop, where the original model is on display. The fictional craft even inspired the name of NASA's prototype space shuttle, says museum curator Margaret Weidekamp.
Well, the very first space shuttle was actually named Enterprise as a result of a write-in campaign orchestrated by Star Trek fans in the 1970s.
That is just one indication of Star Trek's influence, says Weidekamp, who recently appeared on a panel at the museum about Star Trek's relevance. She notes the TV series began airing in the 1960s as women and minorities pressed for equal rights.
Star Trek has been a really important vision, not only of what future spaceflight could look like, but also a reflection of what the hopes were, especially in the 1960s, for what human society could look like. So very importantly, in 1966, it's a mixed-sex, racially integrated, multinational space crew that even includes an alien.
The original series also showed technologies that have become reality, says Nancy Reagan, editor of the book Star Trek and History.
You see the first depiction of a plasma screen TV. You see the first depiction of what I would call a cell phone. I mean, the communicators, they sort of flip open, you know, just like the first cell phone I ever had. You see the first example of Bluetooth technology, where Uhura is wearing the little Bluetooth in her ear. You see the first use of tablets, you know, where they're using multi-touch pads.
Star Trek still inspires engineers, says Mike Gold of Bigelow Aerospace, a Nevada-based company that is developing next-generation spacecraft.
I'd like to think that our entire program is, again, very much in keeping with the spirit of Star Trek, which is to push the boundaries for human exploration.
He says the Bigelow Expander Activity Module will be tested on the International Space Station in 2015. Its acronym, BEAM, harkens back to Star Trek.
Scotty, beam me up.
The newest movie, Star Trek Into Darkness, appeals to fans old and new. The film stars and writer, NASA astronauts, and fans discussed Star Trek's appeal during a Google Hangout. Star Trek fires up the imagination, says astronaut Chell Lindgren.
That's one of the real fun things about these movies and science fiction in general, is just that opportunity to imagine what the future could be like and what technology is going to be like.
Star Trek has been a part of popular culture for nearly 50 years, and with yet another movie in the planning stages, it will continue to inspire people to think about space, the final frontier. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
As you just heard, the newest film in the Star Trek series is now in theaters, bringing thrills to moviegoers throughout many parts of the world. This week, we're going to look back at the original Star Trek starship, the Enterprise, which was first featured in the original 1960s television series. Besides being called the Enterprise, the ship also had a registration number that was prominently displayed on its exterior. What was that registration number? Was it A, NCC 1864, B, NCC 1831, or C, NCC 1701? Well, do you think you have the right answer? We'll tell you the correct answer in just a little bit.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Scientists say a new geologic epoch has begun whereby humans are causing major damage to global water systems. They warn of a planetary transformation comparable to the retreat of the glaciers more than 11,000 years ago. Joe DiCapua reports.
While some still debate the extent to which humans have affected the environment, scientists meeting in Bonn have little doubt. In fact, there's a name for the informal geologic epoch they say human activity has caused, the Anthropocene. Scientists are now debating whether it should be officially included in the geological timescale. Anik Badari is executive officer of the Global Water Systems Project based in Bonn.
For nearly a decade, the Global Water Systems Project has been coordinating and supporting the broad research to study the complex water systems with interactions between natural and human components. And what we found is human activities play a very central role in inducing and influencing the changes in the global water systems.
The project takes a global view of human effects on water systems rather than simply studying very local environments. He calls that a game changer in environmental research.
Humans are impacting the global water systems by building dams through land use changes, and it influences the global water cycle. As a consequence, the global water systems is vulnerable to local-scale human-induced stresses, and it has wide-scale ramifications at larger regional and continental and global scales.
For example, an International Geosphere-Biosphere Program paper says, on average, humanity has built one large dam every day for the last 130 years. It adds, tens of thousands of large dams now distort natural river flows, to which ecosystems and aquatic life adapted over thousands of years. The paper also says groundwater and hydrocarbon pumping in low-lying coastal areas have caused many river deltas to sink. That leaves coastlines more vulnerable to storms and tsunamis. It also says that humans now move more rock and sediment for various reasons than ice, wind, and water combined. Also, the drainage of wetlands for development removes a natural barrier against floods.
The way the global water systems is moving, we may reach a point where it is kind of irreversible. We may not go back to the equilibrium point. There it comes in, the severity of human actions.
The head of the Global Water Systems Project says there can be a trade-off as countries try to ensure water security.
Our global study map shows that human water security has been often achieved in the short run at the expense of the environment. It is true with the developed countries as well as developing countries. We see this kind of a trade-off between human water security and the water needs for ecosystems. And it has long-run social consequences for the socio-ecological systems as a whole. And that's a global issue of concern.
Badari says water security means both water quantity and water quality.
There are nexus between energy security, water security, food security, and environment. And it needs cooperation at the local level, at the policymakers' levels, between different countries also. Otherwise, we will move at a direction where it will be very costly to come back.
Project co-chair Charles Varosmarty says every year, $500 billion worth of concrete, pipes, pumps, and chemicals are thrown at our water problems. He says that has produced a technological curtain separating clean water and the highly stressed natural waters that sit in the background. The four-day meeting in Bonn is expected to release a final communique outlining what steps need to be taken to mitigate the effects of the Anthropocene epoch. In the long term, the Global Water Systems Project is working on Future Earth, an international collaborative environmental research framework. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new United Nations report says AIDS-related deaths in Africa are falling, while the number of Africans getting treatment for the AIDS virus is on the rise. Science World's Bob Doty has the rest of the story.
The report, released this past week, is from the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS and says the number of people in Africa who receive antiretroviral drugs increased from less than 1 million in 2005 to more than 7 million last year. It says AIDS-related deaths fell by nearly a third during that same period and that new HIV infections are also falling. Many African countries have taken steps over the past decade to ensure that at least some of their HIV patients have access to treatment. The report notes that Africa continues to be affected by HIV more than any other region in the world. It says the continent accounts for nearly 70% of people living with the virus worldwide. Along with the positive aspects of the report, it also notes that in 2011, there were still 1.8 million new HIV infections in Africa, and 1.2 million people died of AIDS-related illnesses. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. We want to know the registration number for the original Star Trek Starship Enterprise that was first featured in the 1960s TV series. Was it A, NCC 1831, B, NCC 1864, or C, NCC 1701? The answer is A, NCC 1701. This USS Enterprise, commanded by Captain, later Admiral, James T. Kirk, was featured in the original TV series and the first three Star Trek movies before Kirk and his crew were forced to destroy it in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. The NCC 1701 returned to the silver screen in the 2009 movie version of Star Trek. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
In case you haven't noticed, our son has been kind of cranky lately. Just over the past month alone, a number of news items have reported that the sun has been frequently spitting out solar flares or coronal mass ejections, some of which were described as either powerful or record-breaking in nature. NASA spacecraft that keep an eye on the sun, such as the Solar Dynamics Observatory, have been sending us some spectacular photos of our star ejecting and surrounding itself with incredibly large, bright, and powerful streams of energy. Solar flares basically are explosions on the surface of the sun when it releases powerful blasts of hot gases and waves of energy and light. Coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are blasts of solar winds, magnetic fields, or plasma from or through the sun's atmosphere, or corona. Both solar flares and CMEs have the potential to create some havoc on Earth. Fortunately, thanks to the Earth's atmosphere and its surrounding magnetic fields, we humans are well protected from the dangers of these solar phenomena. But since we've all become so accustomed to living in a much more technological world, solar flares and CMEs could disturb things that depend on electricity, such as the massive power grids that provide power to most of us, or telecommunications facilities that send valuable data and information around the world. Here in the U.S., the Space Weather Prediction Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration monitor the sun's activities and keeps us informed about these solar events with timely space weather forecasts and alerts. Joe Kunches is with this organization and joins us today for our one-on-one segment to tell us about the solar cycle, why our sun has been so active lately, what we might expect in the coming months, and how events such as solar flares and CMEs could affect us all. It sounds like Armageddon.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's the balance that we walk, Rick, is that the sun is so fascinating anyway, and you can look at the imagery that comes down now from satellites, and you can see, you know, amazing eruptive things going on. So it's not too hard to make it sound a little like Armageddon, but at the same time, I think people should take confidence and level of happiness, knowing that you have organizations like our own here at the Space Weather Prediction Center and others around the world that are paying attention to what the sun is doing, and to try to, you know, distill through the hype and through sometimes the overzealous reporting to give people, you know, really the truth of the story, which is that it's usually not as much as it may seem.
Has the sun been much more active as of late?
Yeah, actually, the sun is on a work schedule that goes like this: is that it goes on an 11-year activity cycle, and as it turns out, the month of May in 2013 is thought to be the height of the solar activity cycle. Now, I want to be a little careful about misleading people. It isn't like a particular month necessarily. It's more like even a period of 6 or 8 or 10 months around a particular month. But suffice it to say that there has been a heightened level of activity in the last few weeks, especially last week, where a strong active region was producing strong solar flares and coronal mass ejections, and there were some prospects of geomagnetic storm activity, the stuff that many people like, because that's what causes the auroras to brighten and move closer to the equator. And this week it's quieted down a bit, but I would say this is the time, if you have an interest in space weather, through the summer months, into the winter, even into next summer, you're going to find more occurrences of an eruptive sun.
Now, from what I understand, Joe, this period that we're undergoing right now is something that's called a solar maximus, correct?
Yeah, the solar maximum, again, really has its history in looking at the prevalence of sunspots. And astronomers back into the 1600s and even before, in Galileo's time, were able to see them on a clear day with a piece of paper, and if it's not too windy where you are and there are some large sunspots, you can actually do a pinhole projection over your shoulder in a very crude way. And if you're lucky, you can actually see these dark blemishes on the sun. Well, people started to make a record of that, and they found that for the sun, it does go on about this 11-year cycle in which you go from no sunspots, then it goes up the curve to quite a few sunspots, and then a little longer to decay, it goes back down, think of a roller coaster on the other side, to no sunspots again. And the height of the sunspot cycle is called solar maximum or solar maximus, depending on your Latin there. But for us in the space weather forecasting business, it's important because the magnetic fields that well up from the core of the sun that make the sunspots also provide the energy in the spots for eruptions to occur, and that's where the flares and the coronal mass ejections come from.
Is it possible that we still haven't seen the maximum or the solar maximus, the peak month of solar events?
Yeah, you're right, Rick, because we just don't fully understand the physics and the processes back at the sun that cause both the eruptions to occur and actually the energy to be made available for the eruptions, which are, it's back to the sunspots for a minute. We just don't have a good grasp of that. So it could be the case that it's a little bit of a misnomer when we talk about May of 2013 being the month of the solar maximum. In fact, it could be May of 2014. It is sort of a broad window that you can get periodic, episodic eruptions coming off the sun, even through the times when we call solar minimum, where, from my experience, you will see a rogue sunspot region grow up at the time that the rest of the sun is pretty quiet. We saw this in 2006, coming off of the last solar maximum, where in the time that was supposed to be the low point in the activity cycle, in December of 2006, we had some pretty spectacular activity for about a week's time, just because the conditions can come about where you get, you know, get the oddball that comes up and gives you some activity.
That was Joe Kunches with the U.S. Space Weather Prediction Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.